I have, I don't know what else to call it. It's kind of like I'm in a sugar daze of some sort, like I've eaten too much, but what it is basketball. My goodness, what a weekend, huh? I spent a lot of time right now with a woman from Michigan, and she hates Ohio State. And it's not that I like Ohio State, it's just I didn't ever know to hate Ohio State. And yesterday, she was actually cheering for Gonzaga. Wow. Anyway, and then if you stayed up last night, Michigan got that one shot at the very end. It was wonderful. But to the things at hand, one of the most ambiguously meaningful statements in our society shows up in my office at least once a week. It is so overused, I think, at this point, that when I hear it, I just sort of smile to myself. It is most often used defensively in my office as a couple come in, they sit down, they talk to me about getting married. And one of them inevitably will start out by saying, "Oh, by the way, I'm spiritual, not religious." And 9 times out of 10, I will respond by saying, "You know, me too." There's often a lot of nervous laughter as the person who first used the phrase doesn't understand how I, who in their mind potentially represents the very worst of church institutional hierarchical power mongering and abuse, could possibly share that sentiment with them. They are nervous already coming into the minister's office and are worrying that I'm going to judge them as religiously unfit, not worthy, and require them some religious test, if not at least a moralizing lecture on some issue in order to marry this person that they simply love. Spiritual, not religious. What does it mean? I think it mainly has to do with the fact that most people have a spirituality, most often a very good, deep, and meaningful spirituality, and they distrust religious institutions like ours, like all the others. It's not just personal to us. The growing population of many generations have experienced organized religion as being controlling, demanding, science and common sense denying, and no longer worth the cost of membership. And though we have tried hard, most people who get as far as my office down there still do not know that there can be differences in church communities. That we, for instance, are open, welcoming, and affirming, and simply want to celebrate people's lives with them, and that we will facilitate, more often than not, whatever kind of wedding, baptism, funeral, ceremony that is meaningful to them, together with them, because we are a congregation that takes the sentiments of the prophet Jeremiah quite seriously when he writes, "I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." That is spiritual, not religious. Now, just for some historical context, because that's the way my brain works, Jeremiah was left behind. When the Babylonians took control of Jerusalem, they decimated the city 586-587 BCE, before the Common Era. And eventually, Jeremiah ends up down in Egypt land with a significant crowd of Judeans that escaped south rather than to go north to Babylonia. And those, all the Judeans, whether they went north or whether they went south, they had a crisis. Back in the day, they believed two significant things: that the laws of God and God's very self were in the temple. It was God's very house on earth. And when it was destroyed, along with the written laws on those stone tablets, things had to change. The priesthood, those who were the intermediaries between God and the people of Judah, hey, they were just out of work, right? God's house, the temple, was gone. There was no longer a need for sacrifices to be held to make God pleased with the nation of Judah. To go to the temple and to have sacrifices made to God by the priest. That was the religion of the day. You showed your faithfulness to God by participating in the religious rituals that the law of Moses, the Torah, commanded of all faithful people. What the Babylonians did was multiple, but they did force the evolution of religious practice from a temple activity to something much more personal. Whereas once the law was written on stone and kept in God's house, now the reality of God is written into the hearts of people, which is where God now lives, in us, all around us. God was once singularly located in one spot, and you had to come and visit, and you had to perform rituals like going home to mom's house to honor God, but now God is with us in a most personal way, according to Jeremiah. And for the better part of 500 years, it's hard to imagine the time, 500 years after the destruction of the temple, everyone that was Jewish was spiritual, not religious. You might imagine with me that the crowd that were least in favor of this new temple-free covenant were the priestly class of people like me, whose power and privilege and very job simply evaporated. They were a powerful remnant group that survived, however, over all that 500 years. They finally found themselves back in power under King Herod the Great, who rebuilt the temple in the decades just before Jesus was born, like in the 50 years immediately before Jesus. And the priestly classes were not about power to the people. They were about power strictly managed in the hands of the few, and they sought to erase the laws from the hearts of the people for political gain, one might argue. The second temple, however, stood for less than a century before the Romans just tore it asunder. I do not think that Jesus was a big temple supporter. I think he was a proud Jewish man. I just don't think he was a proud temple supporter. He seemed to be more of an anti-temple person. He was from the north, up in Galilee, and they were an independent, fiery, fiercely personal people in their faith. They worshiped God, they served the same God in many places without the controlling influences of the religious elite in Jerusalem. And as we begin this week to lean toward that week in our calendar year where we remember Jesus' death in Jerusalem, we need to remember that Jesus came to Jerusalem, perhaps for the first time in his life, as one who was spiritual and not religious, spiritually free and not a supporter of the political religious dynamism that he viewed as detrimental to the people, 90% of whom were living under the oppressive heels of Rome and a temple system that further bled the people of resources and from fully appreciating that God's reality was already fully written on their hearts. No temple needed, no alliance with Rome required. That's what he walked into. What is it like to have God's law written on your hearts? What would it be like to have God's presence experienced as near as our heartbeat? For most of us, I suspect, we sense a gap between God's vision and our behaviors and attitudes. Could just be me. Often, I think God appears externally, ready to judge us for our imperfections, or as a voice of conscience alerting us when we've gone astray, or as a force going against our individual self-interests. Jeremiah promises a different kind of religious experience, a spiritual experience, the experience of being in tune with God's vision of ourselves and our society and having our heart beat in sync with God's. A new heart is a gift of grace. God initiates this new covenant, this new promise. But is God the only actor? Is God's action entirely unilateral? Or do we have a role in our alignment with God's vision? Surely God can do a new thing in accordance with God's own choosing, and God can choose to be more active in some places more than others. God can address us in lively and energetic ways. Still, I think God's call, God's presence in our lives, invites us to have to respond. And our response emerges from a partnership between God and us that enhances rather than minimizes our creativity and freedom. And nothing else at that point can have a hold on us. And I find myself wondering, are you waiting? Are you waiting to use your voice? Are you waiting to use your power, your life, for justice until you've got the education, until you retire and you finally got the money? Are you waiting for institutional clearance, the world's permission to be heard? Well, there's no line, no waiting, if the time is now. If there's something that you're passionate about, some possibility that has ignited your imagination to make some corner of the world a little more like the visible sign, the visible presence of God's love, God's peace, God's justice, and God's blessing, you need no permission from the rulers of this world. Those who use the power they have to maintain their privilege would like nothing better than for us to sit back and wait for their authorization. But we don't need it. These are days of fairly great anxiety in our society. There are wars and rumors of wars, elected and unelected men of power being cast away. There are changes afoot, and there are plenty of self-appointed prophets of doom ready to tell us that we should be afraid, that we need to stay the course, just 3 more years, toe the line, do what they tell us, lest something even more terrible falls upon us. But what if Jesus is right and the time is now? What if God is fully present with us, heart to heart, and that now is the time to move forward with our spirituality, religion cast aside, and move our lives and world more toward what God is dreaming through us for it to become? If Jesus is right, then we don't need to fear being spiritual, not religious. We simply need to follow where our heart is tugging at us and God is luring us to go. We need to follow. The God Jesus proclaimed, the God who created the universe, if you will, is still drawing the universe toward the justice for which it aches. That God is calling you this morning. The days are surely coming. God wants to inscribe God's just and liberating words on our hearts. And all, from the least to the greatest, will know it, experience it, and celebrate it. What if the time is now for us to be found spiritual, not religious? Is now the time for you and God to move in sync? The answer is an unqualified yes.